point.
Yes.
Keep me signed in, even though she's Skype. But she needs to be signed in order to speak.
I'll allow it. It's okay. I haven't actually, like, she hasn't had a music friend that knows what's going on. So
here,
wait.
Here.
Okay.
So I have her on my phone. Are we good?
She's good. Yeah.
Okay. Perfect.
Thank you. Thank you.
There you go. We're lucky to have so many of these join us by our council. I feel that we're really lucky. We're really lucky.
If you'd like, yeah, you can stand.
We're really lucky to have the board chair of the Board of Governors of the University of Alberta here with us today. But not only are we lucky to have him with us here today, we're lucky to have a Board of Governors that values the relationship with the student body. And we're really lucky to be part of a university that's determined to compete with the best public research and teaching intensive universities across the world. So that Doug Goss today is here to present really briefly the role of the Board of Governors as well as the vision that they have for the university. And after that, Sadiq will be moderating questions, and we'll be taking questions as well as working on the written questions that we have all submitted today. So that being said, yeah.
Just give me one second. I'll call me to our
audience. With that, I'll pass the floor over to.
Well, I think we're going to do attendance first.
Yeah. Attendance first?
Yeah. So we'll call this meeting to order at 6:08 p.m. We'll just take attendance very quickly. If it's okay with Councillor Bannister, we'll move her nomination until after the presentation, if that's okay. So we'll just do attendance really quickly. I'll explain a couple things about the presentation, and then I'll open the floor to any motions that need to be made for suspension of rules, etc. Then we can move on with the presentation. So just get started. President Lau.
Present.
Vice President Ordzik.
Present.
Vice President Kinda.
Present.
Vice President Hodgson.
Here.
Vice President Diaz.
Present.
Governor Hansera.
Present.
Councillor Allard.
Present.
Councillor Chen.
Present.
Councillor Bannister.
Present.
Councillor Dueck.
Present.
Councillor Sleeman.
Present.
Councillor Zhang. Councillor Zhang? He's here. Mr. Kim for Councillor Jadak.
Present.
Councillor Gruelke. I'm going to butcher this name. Councillor Bryce's proxy, are you here? Cassian.
Try it.
Salty Kevich.
Very good.
Is that actually how it's pronounced?
Salty Kevich.
Salty Kevich. Mr. Rudy for Councillor Papatunde.
Present.
Councillor Horvat.
Present.
Councillor Fedoski.
Present.
Councillor Jacobson. Councillor Wong.
Yeah.
Councillor Garg. Councillor Gore. Mr. Janevsky for Councillor Khan. Councillor Krutzy.
Present.
Councillor Morris. Councillor Bhatia. Councillor Hooper. Councillor Champagne.
Is that?
Councillor, or Mr. Rahman for Councillor Pinchik. Councillor Zinedine, Councillor Kwan,
present.
No longer members to his councillor. Councillor Huang,
present.
Councillor Farouk,
present.
Councillor Hudson,
present.
And I'm here. All right, so just to go over a couple of quick things before the presentation begins. Basically, for those members of Students' Council who did submit questions, or those members of Students' Council who are not members of Students' Council who submitted questions. Just to give you a little bit of an update as to my email that I sent out earlier. Basically, because of the way our standing orders work, counselors have priority for speaking turns unless they decide to generously defer their speaking turns to you as guests of Students' Council. So if you are a guest of Students' Council, if you're not a proxy for somebody, or if you're not a member of Students' Council, we'll wait until sort of all counselors have had their fill, and then you can
point of parliamentary.
Yes.
If we've suspended standing orders, can we suspend? We can suspend that rule.
Yes, you can also suspend that rule as well. But basically, how it's going to work is essentially it's just going to be, once again, not according to my email. It's going to be a free for all. Placards up. Whoever's first. That's how it's going to go. Hopefully for those counselors and non-counselors who submitted questions, you can still, you know, ask your question to the board chair, because he's here with us. But other than that, I'll entertain a motion to suspend standing orders. Governor Hansara.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I'd like to make a motion to suspend standing orders to allow all guests of council to ask the board chair questions and to take part in the presentation as any councillor would be able to. And I'd also like to suspend standing orders by extending the time limit to 7:50.
So 1 hour. Is there a seconder for this particular motion? Councillor Sleeman. Suspension of rules is not debatable, not amendable, and requires a two-thirds majority. All those in favor of suspending standing orders? All those opposed? Any abstentions that wish to be noted? Wonderful. So with that, we'll move on to the presentation. The University of Alberta Board of Governors by Board Chair Doug Goss, sponsored by President Lau and Governor Hansara. Is there any opposition to viewing this presentation? Seeing none.
Good, there's not much to view, but here I am. So, first of all, thank you for inviting me. Thanks to William and Sangram for their commitment, not only to the Students' Union, but they do a terrific job on our Board of Governors. It's a complicated place, a university. I've certainly come to know that in intimate detail. It's got a number of stakeholders and constituency groups that care passionately about the future of this place. I'm reading our vision of excellence. We know what we stand for, and we shape our destiny. That's really what we're all here to do, to shape our destiny and where we're going, not just as a university, but this is an incredibly important time for this province. Really, the world's eyes are on this province, and for good reason. In 1966, Peter Lougheed wrote the guidepost for the Progressive Conservative Party, and one of the tenets, one of the main guideposts, was the last one he wrote, and he said, it's not unrealistic for this province, with the resources it has, to aspire to build a jurisdiction not inferior to any other place in North America. And I would hazard a guess, if Peter was alive today, he'd say a jurisdiction not inferior to any other place on this planet. He just wrote that in 1966. I mean, you know the adage, to whom much is given, much is required. But we are in an extraordinary place right now as a province. We have unbridled resources, but with that comes immense responsibility. And that responsibility is to do just what we stand for, to shape our destiny, to do things, to demonstrate clear relevance to society, to world issues, to our community. Why are we here? What are we trying to get done? What are we trying to solve? This institution, it's been around over 100 years, was formed shortly after the province was formed in 1905, is absolutely a beacon for this notion that this province needs to aspire to achieve at the highest possible levels. So that's why I was so very pleased last April when we got together as governors, which was a multifaceted group of stakeholders from academic staff and non-academic staff and deans and grad students and professors and governors. There's 40-some people in the room who at the end of 3 days said, we see ourselves as a public teaching research intensive university that competes with the best in the world, full stop. And I would suggest to you that we can't aspire to do anything less than that right now. For a province like of ours, I'll tell you, it's a bit of a side note. I've got a good friend who chairs the board of the University of Waterloo, and he tells me, he said, you know, Doug, we live in absolute fear in Ontario that you guys are going to figure out you could compete, that you guys could put together a post-secondary system that nobody, frankly, in Canada could compete with, let alone in other places in the world. We sit here in Alberta. We have $30 billion in the bank. We have no debt. And you compare that to the province of Ontario with $300 billion in debt, a $12 to $14 billion operating deficit each and every year. Now, what's our responsibility? Our responsibility is to build an institution that does that, that solves the great problems of society, that takes on challenges and world issues, that becomes known as the place you go to get things done and accomplished. That's what we're here for. That's what drives me every day that I come to work on this incredibly interesting but non-paying volunteer job. I do this because I believe this, that this is at such a critical time for this province to get it right to be a jurisdiction that is not inferior and sees itself as not inferior to any other place in the world. How does the university play into that? Well, the university's, you know, absolutely a beacon. It's one of those measuring sticks. As this university succeeds, so does our society. So does the citizens we produce. I know we've got one of the, I think just one, but one of the members of the leadership program in the business school right now. The Peter Lougheed, I think there's some questions on this later, the Peter Lougheed Leadership Initiative was really just about that. It was to suggest that we believe as a university that the notion of leading and mentoring and producing great citizens is of immense value to society. And we put so much faith in that, into that notion, that we're actually going to put together a leadership initiative that's solely focused on the notion that being a great leader and having the ability to affect change in a positive way in society is a really important thing. So if you're interested in that, come to this institution. And I don't care what faculty you're from, if you're interested in leadership, you have access to that tool. It's in our toolkit that we can offer programs of leadership. So I was asked to talk a little bit about the change agenda. What's the change agenda? The change agenda is simple. Change agenda is simply to say that we do aspire to be a public teaching research intensive university that competes with the best in the world. But we have to know we're doing that. We have to know we're actually accomplishing that. So the change agenda is about quality control to say, what are the metrics that define great institutions? And how do we measure up on a faculty by faculty basis, a department by department basis? How does our tuition compare to great universities? At the end of the day, what are we accomplishing to solve some of these things to society, to the world, and to our community? And that's all the change agenda is. And it's to say it's about positive incremental change, where we actually have key quality control indicators that say we're moving in the right direction, we're getting it right, and that we, as a university community, are working together to fulfill that notion that we are aspiring to compete at the very highest levels. It's not a race for second. It's not a race to mediocrity. We want to achieve at the highest possible levels. Part of Peter Lougheed's tenet of being a jurisdiction not inferior to any other jurisdiction in the world had a side note to it. And that side note was to always guard against complacency. Never be satisfied. Push, push, push. And when you think you push as hard as you can, you push more. Because if you're not pushing, you're not going forward. And somebody's going by you. So we need to do that, and we need to foster that as a culture, as a DNA of this institution. And we have to look at everything we do and say, do we do this at the highest possible level? And if we don't, how do we get better? How do we change it? And how do we measure it out so that we know we're getting better? So that's what the change agenda is about. We've put some detailed things in front of our administration to talk about how we're. It's interesting because Sandra McWilliam will appreciate this. The Auditor General, when he gave this, when he came to his report, he said, you guys have great books, your auditor statements, they're unqualified, but how do you know you're getting better? How do you know you're performing well? He said, what do you guys look to as key indicators, key performance indicators to really show as an institution you're starting to build and go and do things, frankly, that are true to your mission? And he makes a good point. We've got to be better at some of those things. So we can all stand up and say, when somebody comes to you and says, you know what, we want a tuition increase. Well, why? Why? I mean, is it going to help us get better? If it is, how does it fit with the rest of the agenda? So all these things have to fit. They all have to fit. But you know you're getting there if you are collectively bought into a vision that does that. You don't mind paying tuition for that because you know you're part of an institution that's not only giving you a degree that means something, but you're part of a culture that you know is able and ready to solve some of the world's great problems. That's what we got to aspire to. So That's all the change then is. That's all I've been pushing. You'll hear me ad nauseum talk about this. I'll be unrelenting as your board chair, as I have been for the last couple of years, because I firmly believe that this is such an important time. The eyes of the world are on this province right now for lots of reasons, and all of you are acutely aware what those are. If we don't take on some of the big challenges of the world and say we're up to it, yeah, sure, we've been given a lot, but we're doing a lot. But we don't do that. You know, we risk a lot as a society and as a jurisdiction. I'm not prepared to sit back and let that happen. So my message to all of you guys is we're all in this together. We collectively can affect that change. We collectively can build that institution, which for generations to come will shape the destiny of not just Albertans, but Canadians and hopefully people around the world. You know, the mayor of New York, Michael Bloomberg, last year gave another $350 million to Johns Hopkins University, upping his personal contribution to that university to over $1 billion. And when asked why, he said, because he knows of no other investment which will pay greater dividends to his city, his state, and here's the big one, and humanity than an investment in that institution. So, what are we aiming for? We're aiming to build that institution that solves the world's great problems. So not just government and taxpayers say an investment in the University of Alberta pays dividends, but all of us say this is the place to get things done. That's what we're aspiring to build. That institution that does exactly what you said. So, that's all I have to say on that. I know you got a ton of questions, and I'd rather spend the rest of my time seeing if we can answer those.
Any questions?
Yes, Mr. Muhammad.
So, do the averages for applicants to the University of Alberta have been going up?
Sorry, say that again.
Admission averages to the University of Alberta have been going up for the past few years. Do you see any negative effects from that?
Well, absolutely. I mean, it's very, very frustrating that, you know, we've built some incredible infrastructure in this university. We've got lots of room for more students. And the only thing that's holding us back right now, bringing more students in, is government funding those spaces. So, you know, for me, you know, I can't remember what the average is coming in grade 12, but it's kind of low 80s, something like that, right? And I got into business school. Somebody just told me, kind of a gal that Joe and I know. I'm sitting up here, by the way. It's our date night, so be very careful. I think her daughter had maybe two average, couldn't get into science. And I said, come on. You got to be better than that. And there's room, right? It's not like there isn't any room. It's just that we got to fund those spaces. That comes back to our commitment as a province to, you know, you got one chance to convert resource capital to human capital. Because once the resource capital is gone, it's gone forever. And if we haven't built a mechanism to produce human capital at a rate greater than other jurisdictions in the world, we fall behind. It's that simple. So we need to invest like there's no tomorrow in you guys, in our future. And if we've built the space, it's an absolute crime that people can't get into a university if they're achieving at relatively high levels. Now, that's not to say this is a university just for anybody. We do want to achieve it. You know, we do want to set high standards. But, you know, we also want to make sure that Albertans have access to good quality post-secondary education. And so, you know, there's always a balance there.
Vice President Rizek.
Thank you so much for coming to present to us today. My question for you is, I've noticed that there's a lot of emphasis on a centralization of power in the hands of the president of the university and the change agenda. I'm wondering if you could explain the link between this and the leading of the university to excellence.
Sure. I wouldn't call it so much even centralization of the presidents, but having a centralized quality control system that we know on a faculty by faculty basis we're doing things as we should. So we've evolved as an institution to a really highly decentralized, fragmented institution in many, many ways. Faculties run quite independently from each other. Standards on how we bring in grad students, for instance, is just as an example, vary from faculty to faculty. And what we suggested as governors is that if we're really going to be true to the mission of building an institution that competes with the best in the world, then we should have some standardized quality control measures that we know on a faculty by faculty, department by department basis, that we're in fact doing things at the highest level. And the only way you can do that is if you have some central control or reporting that says, if you're not doing it properly, then we're going to step in and ask why and see if we can figure out a way to start to achieve at the highest levels. Because we, you know, when we're only as strong as our weakest link, and so to the extent that we can put in place quality control measures that actually drive performance, drive how we do things, I think we're all in better shape. So that's all that's about.
Thank you.
Councillor Chen.
Thanks for coming and being with us today. As international students, I want to ask a question about our international student issues. So we all know that the university administration promised a number of things during the heated student international differential fees debate. So, and also, one of which was like the increased financial aid for international students, and also to improve the services for international students.
Yeah, so a concierge type service, right? To one stop shopping if you've got issues that you need solved. Yeah, I think that was how I understood it.
So we want to know what's the current progress on both of these promises, and are there any other metrics for success that the institution is aiming for? And will there be another proposal for IDEA increase?
You're talking about the differential increase?
Yes.
Yeah. I really have no idea about that. As far as the relief that was promised, I bloody well hope so. I mean, I sat in a board meeting, I think it was December, when that was passed, and that was a very interesting process because, at the end of the day, it became about, it was 5%, and it became apparent that at least anecdotally, because they were standing in council chambers, that people would say, wait a minute, people are going to suffer here because they need the help financially. So we said, okay, what's in place? If it isn't enough, let's beef it up. Let's make sure every international student knows what the programs are, so they have financial distress, they know where to go, that it's easy to access, and that there's enough funds in there to deal with the issue. I mean, that's what it's there for. So I assume all that's happening because that was the clear direction from the board meeting. If it's not, I'd love to hear about it because that was the clear directive to the university. And again, we're going to be a university that respects and brings in students from around the world because we want to be an institution that people want to come to. We want to make it easy for you to come here. We want to make sure that when you come here that if you're experiencing financial distress for all the right reasons that we can help you. And that's what it's there for.
Councilor Sleeman.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Thank you for your presentation as well. My question is regarding tuition. The tuition and fees regulation states that the university must annually consult with students about tuition increases. And for real consultation to occur, the students really need to know about planned increases to tuition, whether they be mandatory non-instructional fees, market modifiers, international and differential fee, or tuition fees. With this in mind, is the university currently planning increases to tuition through any of the aforementioned means? So what stages are these proposals in, and when will they be discussed with us?
Right, all that has to happen. I don't have any direct knowledge of what's coming forward, but I can assure you it's going to come forward in the proper processes. And absolutely, you've got to be consulted. I mean, that's what this is about. It's about transparency, about making sure we've addressed all of the issues, and if we get collectively to the right issue that says this makes sense, then we'll proceed, but we won't do it any other way.
Mr. Rahman.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker, and Mr. Dukosper, for me to speak to us. My question is really related to the manifest your message about how we really want to have a world-class institution, but the previous 2 years we've been cut very deeply. We've seen a lot of our staff be either laid off or retired, or they've taken voluntary severance packages and retired early. And we've also seen a lot of dedicated sessional instructors be laid off. So what we're going to see as students is probably that teaching workloads are going to increase, and in conjunction with that, we expect something like teaching quality would decrease. So what's being offered, or what's being done to reduce the impacts of, what's being done to reduce the impacts from the loss of both support and academic staff for the entire institution, as well as particularly with respect to teaching quality?
Yeah, great question. I mean, I told you the Ontario story. So, board chair of the University of Waterloo, with all their issues last year, $300 billion in debt and $12 to $14 billion operating deficit, they found more money to invest in post-secondary because they think it's their way out of the woods. Here we sit to balance a $400 million deficit, perceived $400 million deficit, actually turned to a $700 billion surplus this year. We cut post-secondary spending 10%. I mean, talk about a jurisdiction not getting it right about investing in the future, your future. I mean, it was ludicrous, and you saw me being very vocal about that, and we stood up, frankly, where other institutions in this province didn't. And we made a difference. We got some reinvestment back into the sector, and I think we made it very clear that this isn't something we can stand for as a people that aspire to build a jurisdiction not appear to any other place in the world. We can't do that. So that being said, governments are all about, to get them to think longer than, a year, let alone 3 years or 5 years, is not always easy. But, we're there to try and do that. At the other side of things, we do have the ability to control some of those things that are within our control. So you've seen us take some steps this year, for instance, on land trusts. We're for the first time, this has been talked about since the mid-80s, but we will set up a land trust, but we're actually going to be developing some of our assets in partnership with the private sector, which will be a net benefit to our institution. That's served the University of British Columbia extremely well. They moved their land assets into a land trust in the mid-80s. It's probably generating about $500 million of value for that institution. $500 million in discretionary spending of this institution would help solve some of those issues that you're talking about, recruiting the best, keeping the best, teaching quality, number of professors, all of those things that go into the metrics of what define a great institution. So that's one thing. We've got to up our game on philanthropy. And you'll see some very concerted efforts on the advancement file over the next number of years. I'm personally overseeing the launching of a fairly major endowment campaign for the university, which will launch in the next couple of years. That's the edge. I mean, we still have this great advantage here, and I can tell you, as the guy who's chairing the Presidential Search Committee, that this is a university that people want to come to because they know what the potential is. As an intensely publicly funded jurisdiction, still 60 to 65% of our operating budget gets funded by government. Any other jurisdiction in the world would love those numbers. Okay. Our key is what's the margin that we do above that? How do we create that sizzle, those extra margins of dollars that allow us to achieve at higher levels? That's about advancement. That's about making sure we're producing revenue in our faculties where we can. That's about maximizing the value of land trusts and all those types of things which give us that margin of excellence. And so I'm determined that we're going to not just rely on government to get to solve all our problems. We've got to solve some of these problems ourselves.
Thank you. Councillor Hudson.
Hi there. Thank you for coming. So my question is in regards to the cancellation of classes and seminars and labs that's been happening, what is the plan to counteract this? Because from talking to various students in all different faculties, I've received feedback that students are having to reevaluate their academic plans because some of these classes have been canceled. So if they're in smaller minors or majors, that can mean that they may have to reevaluate and take their courses at different years. So their standard four-year program might be extended to a 5 or 6 year program. As well, I've also found that some of the seminars, such as the biology seminars, have been canceled. And these seminars are very crucial to students because it not only teaches them how to write well thought out papers, but it also provides them with different outlets so that they can show that they've got these different skills, because not all students are good at writing tests, and it gives them a different opportunity to prove themselves that they know the knowledge. So I just wanted to repeat, what is the plan of attack?
Well, I can't tell you what the plan is. You know, my job as a board chair doesn't get to that sort of granular level, but what we do get to this committee is just that question. If you're in the science faculty, are we giving you all the tools so you can compete at the highest level? To those we profess to compete. And if those are tools that other universities have in their arsenal to offer to their students to give them the best possible quality, then we should be doing that too. So if those things are being cut, then those are questions that have come before our governors, are going to come to committee, and people are going to ask tough questions. They're going to say, what the hell are you doing? You know?
And then just to interject, that's the role that that we serve, and both, you know, the deans are the ICE president, the ICE association. That's a huge lobbying association that we can all do, in making sure that our faculty administration and larger administration get to hear these issues, and we've got to work together to become more effective at making these issues heard so that we can improve the quality of education that we have.
If there was unlimited resources, you know, we'd do everything. We don't have unlimited resources, so we do have to make tough choices. But if we're going to be true to our vision, those tough choices need to revolve around getting us to the right places. Now, maybe there are faculties or departments that are underperforming, and we have to evaluate how they do things. Maybe they have to do things differently, or with somebody, in collaboration with somebody else, or with some shared resources, or something that allows us to achieve at the highest levels. And it will, you know, change by its nature means. You do have to make tough decisions. You know, the notion, the historic notion of how great universities were built was on this notion of academic freedom, and I'm a huge believer in academic freedom. But academic freedom doesn't mean you can do whatever you want, whenever you want, when someone else is paying the freight. And, you know, sometimes along the way, you've got to make those tough decisions about whether or not those who are paying the freight think your project is relevant enough to achieve your ultimate goal here, which is creating a university that competes at the highest levels and solves some of the world's great problems. So that does, by definition, mean we have to make choices.
So before I continue on with the rest of the speakers list, somebody requested that I put this up on the projector so that people have an idea of when they're going to be speaking, just because there's a lot of people on the speakers list, so hopefully that's all right. Mr. Kim.
Okay, again, thanks for coming and speaking with us. So I'm going to ask you a selfish question. I'm from the Faculty of Arts, and I care deeply about liberal arts education and humanities education, and it seems like the university has been investing a lot on health sciences or engineering during the past few years, and this is a worldwide trend in that liberal arts, humanities, social sciences are getting pushed aside. So, and then it seems like we're being a little bit complacent about the value of liberal arts education. So I was wondering if the board is aware of this issue and whether there's any long-term plan, special measures to counteract this, decline of the liberal arts education.
It's a great question. We're aware, because I get guys like you asking questions like this to me all the time. Hey, what's going on here? Like, you know, arts matters. You know, interesting, you know, Google just hired 5,000 people. They didn't hire engineers. They didn't hire chemists. They hired people with liberal arts education. They want people who can look at the world through a different lens. They want to see problems differently. And again, to solve those issues, those problems. Liberal arts is fundamental to what we do as as an institution that creates great citizens, great leaders of the world. So you've got to ask those same questions, right? They need to be heard at all at the highest levels. That if that arts does matter, and this faculty, if it's not competing with the best, we've got to figure out why and how we get it back to those levels. So, push, keep pushing. We all got to push, because I believe in liberal arts.
Vice President Hoytzer.
Thanks again. I'm back. I'm full of questions. I was wondering if you knew whether or not the MORC report was finished, and if you could explain a little bit how it will be used to reach the goals of the change agenda.
The
MORC report, the review of governance.
I don't know. I honestly don't. So don't have any knowledge of that.
Thanks.
Councillor Zhang.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Thank you again for allowing us to engage in conversation with you, and I hope we have more opportunity like this in the future.
Me too.
My question is regarding a statement that you made when you were elected board chair. You said that you intended to fundraise $1 billion for the university, and I have a couple questions regarding this. And first, I wanted to know, I couldn't really find anything. Is there a time frame that either you or the Board of Governors had in mind for this $1 billion goal? And also, how has our progress been? Have we been hitting our fundraising targets? And if not, is there anything that you're trying to do to include that process? And also, how much of the $1 billion is left to raise?
Okay, great questions. Fundamentally, when you're going out to those who are alumni or industry and say, back to my Michael Bloomberg analogy, where you come back and say, fundamentally, why would you make this investment? When we get asked that question, we have to have those answers. So the last couple of years have been really planning for that, and actually the campaign will be $1.5 billion, probably not $1 billion, but and fundamentally it is about just that. It's making sure that foundation, that strategic foundation of what defines us as an institution, and why an investment of $100 million in this institution is going to pay dividends. So we have to get that right, and William and Sanger will know, we set up an advancement board committee, which is really to go to our alumni and people who care passionately as successful business people about this institution, and use them as a sounding board for a strategic plan for this institution, and say, here's the pillars of what are going to define this institution, and does this resonate, and does this plan offer some incentive for you to be a big financial supporter of this institution? So there's another key component to this, which we'll have some news on, I think, fairly quickly, and that was the government announced in 2005, something like that, an Access to the Future Fund, which was set up to match private sector donations. And unfortunately, what happened with that fund was it got so oversubscribed that we've had a number of donors. We actually raised $500 million in 2008 around the centennial. Our endowment sits right now at just over $1 billion, which is decent, for a Canadian university of our size and stature. But what the government's realized and what we realized is that the backlog of donations under the Access to the Future Fund had to get fixed, because we had these same donors who we'll be going back to for this next campaign. Some of them gave many multi-million dollar gifts in 2008, and those gifts have never been matched. And it's a source of some aggravation. So, we've brought that to the government's attention. It's actually one of the things I wanted to get accomplished when I came on as board chair, and I think you're going to see some action on that very, very quickly, and that will do two things. One, it's going to boost our endowment up, which is going to be great. But two, it'll clear off that sort of aggravation of donors who have given us significant funds whose gifts have never been matched, and we needed to fix that. So. But we're well on the way on that. I think you'll see the campaign launch probably in the next 2 years. you know, we're right in the middle of a presidential search. We'll want to bring the new president on sort of in advance of that and have them part of that. In the meantime, we're going to work very hard on the strategic plan for the institution to make sure that our faculties are aligned, that we're setting up cross-disciplinary initiatives that solve some of the world's great big issues. And we want this to be the institution that does that. So that's part of the magic of the strategic plan that resonates with donors. They want to make a difference. But people don't want to just give money. They want to know that their dollars are making a difference, and they're giving it to an institution that respects that and is getting it done.
Thank you for your time again. So I was just wondering, when will the university renegotiate their contract with the academic staff and non-academic staff association? And what stance is the university going to assume in the negotiations, and how would it potentially impact the university's work?
Well, that's a really easy question. No, I'm actually kidding. No, I'll be honest, I can't answer that. We're in the middle of discussions right now with BAFTA and the non-academic staff, and it's a collective bargaining process, which, frankly, we don't get into at my level until it's ratified and negotiated. So, it'll be a challenging time because the government signaled last year they cut our budget, whatever it was, 7%, which is effectively a 10% cut because we were looking at a 2% increase, which turned into a 7% decrease, so the swing was 10%, which is significant. We don't have those kind of dollars just sticking around. They've kind of signaled to us not to expect any increases. At the same time, they just negotiated a settlement with AUPE, which gave AUPE 3-4%. So, it's going to be very tricky how that gets negotiated. A lot of smarter guys than me are leading that charge, and we'll just see where it gets.
Councilor White.
Thank you very much for your presentation. We really appreciate your time, and I hope this reflects a future of further improved communication and working relationship between the Students' Union and the Board of Governors and Administration. So the University Administration has made a promise to the Students' Union and the public that the Peter Lougheed Leadership College Initiative would touch at least one-third of the University of Alberta undergraduate population. And I'm just wondering what the progress is on this, and when you expect we will reach that target.
Oh boy, that's a great question. Right now, the leadership, who's in the leadership college here in the business faculty? What is there, 12? That program, 18? I'm trying to remember.
The first year was 12, my year is 16.
Yeah, so we got a long ways to go to hit 10,000, right? But the point is, here's the point, right? The point is, again, as one of those principles of an institution that is trying to define itself and distinguish itself, and those values or qualities or characteristics that define us as an institution. What we're seeing is leadership's important, that we believe in that. So so much so that leadership program is going to morph into a college, which is going to morph into a whole series of programs that you can access from wherever you are in this university. So you have access to the notion that leadership can be learned, qualities of leadership can be learned. You believe that?
Leadership can be learned.
Yeah. And that's the point, right? The point is, so, again, that's something we all have to, if we believe that, as an institution, that producing great citizens is what we do, and one of the qualities of great citizens is the ability to lead or mentor, whether you're leading one, two, a scout troop, a hockey team, a business, a city, a province, or a country, it's those same qualities. And what we're saying is we believe in that. We believe that we want to produce those kind of students, those kind of citizens that can contribute back to the world and solve the world's big problems. So that it will be ongoing. I'd love to see the thing reach everybody. I mean, ideally, if you're interested in leadership, this is the place to come.
Councillor Horvath.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Thank you very much for attending. I know that your position on the board is a volunteer position, so I'm deeply grateful that you want to spend time here with us. I'm just kind of curious about what your view is of the university in the next, let's say, 10, 20, 30 years, in terms of what tangible changes will happen. I know that right now we have a lot of excellence in terms of research and undergraduate programs, but I'm thinking more of the stuff that we already have, not things that are coming up like the Land Trust or the Leadership Group. What's going to change with that to make the university more excellent? What's your idea of how that's going to change?
Well, those are great questions. And I think probably the most important thing is just the aspirations that we have collectively to make sure that whatever it is, what department, what faculty you're in, is actually taking the time to strategically take a look at what it's doing, what it's trying to accomplish, and is it doing it at the highest possible level? If it can, if it isn't, then how are we changing that paradigm to make it work? And, you know, it's at the larger level, you'll see visiting committees coming in to all, you know, faculties. I think there's three of them coming in this year in business. I'm trying to remember what the other two are. But again, this is where people are coming in from institutions that we're professing. You guys do it really well. Come and take a look at our program and tell us how you think we're doing. And if you think we do it really well, if not, if we are great, if you think we can do it better, show us how. And let's take the time. Not to just keep doing things the same, but how do we keep it? That's what change is about, right? It's positive, incremental change. It's not that this is a fixer-upper, that we've got a big problem here. That's not it at all. It's how do we push, take it to the next level, each and every year.
Vice President Hodgson.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, and again, thank you so much for being here tonight. I'm curious, given the recent controversy at University of Saskatchewan in the Transform Us program process, and the fact that our president wrote a letter criticizing the board's actions at the U of S, I'm curious, what are the takeaways there for consultation and properly engaging university stakeholders on a broad kind of change agenda or change program?
Great question. I mean, it's, you know, if you looked at that process, which I've done, the process they followed, it's not really dissimilar in a lot of ways from the change agenda and some of the things that we're trying to push forward. If you look at the Renaissance report that was written last year, 74 recommendations on how we might improve things. A lot of the things in the Transform Us are right in that report. Where they stub their toe is on execution. You know, it's change is never easy, and I would say it's increasingly more difficult in the context of universities like ours, who have a long history of how they do things. You saw academic freedom mentioned in there, and you know the ability to speak your mind or pursue whatever pursuit it is. But that was a different process. I mean, they talked about how are we going to get better as a university? How do we make changes that we think are in the best interest of the university? I think in that particular one, it was about the Faculty of Public Health merging into the Faculty of Medicine. Well, that's been talked about here. You know, we've got 8 faculties, more or less, on the health side, including the Faculty of Medicine and Dentistry. Is there some ways that we can merge these together that we can be more efficient, that we can do things better? But those things are all on the table. Where they stub their toe is on the execution, because clearly, they didn't have everybody aligned on the strategy. And you can talk about some of the process issues that they went through on the governance side, which I'm sure it'll be one for the history books and case books of governance that people will read about for a long time to come, because you know, clearly there were some mistakes made on a whole bunch of different levels. But my takeaway from it is that if you are making changes, make sure everybody's on board. Take the time to review the processes, to go through the tough decisions. And that it doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be positive for everybody, but if you believe in the whole, in the greater, the collective strategy of producing this institution that's on the rise and doing the right things, then people will come along. But you've got to make sure you've got people on board. The worst thing you can do as a leader is be leading and turn around and there's nobody behind you. It's pretty tough to lead that army.
Just because we're running short on time, I'm going to allow the people who haven't had the chance to ask any questions to have priority, just so council's aware. Mrs. Zimi.
Thank you. Again, to echo everyone else, thanks for coming and thanks for the Students' Council for letting guests engage in this conversation. This question is regarding the lab fees that are currently being discussed in faculty sizing. Kind of bear with me because I just want to set the scene before I ask you the question. Dean Schaefer has made it clear that despite the fact that the budget is not going to be balanced on students' back for this year or the next couple of years, the administration intends on introducing lab fees. And obviously, this proposal doesn't sit easy with students because especially in programs like chemistry and earth and atmospheric sciences, there's going to be an increase in education costs. And cost of education shouldn't be prohibitive or a deciding factor when students want to choose what programs they want to pursue. So with that in mind, the dean's justification is that lab fees is being introduced to combat inflation or to grow our faculty as a whole. But this kind of works under the convenient assumption that that kind of relies on this flawed notion that tuition increases or cost of education should be increasing to match inflation, which isn't usually true. And it's they kind of avoid looking at it as a direct consequence of decreased public interest and investment into our universities and the people who attend them. Now, bearing all this in mind, the Science Faculty Association is, we're just interested in knowing what the board's views are on this and, like, just knowing what the pros and cons are from your perspective and what kinds of plans are being introduced and discussed to combat further fees being continuously introduced and increased.
Well, I honestly have no opinion on the lab fee thing. My comments will be at a very, very high level and not surprisingly. Any fee increase that has to be taken in the whole context of what it is we're trying to achieve. And is it the best possible solution for what it is we're trying to achieve? And are there any other avenues we can pursue? So, I would just encourage you to continue to be part of the debate. I can assure you when it gets to committee, and those things do come to committee, all those questions will be asked. They'll be delved into, and we're not just about hiking fees for the sake of hiking fees. It's got to make sense. And it's got to make sense in the context of what it is we're trying to achieve as an institution that wants to achieve at high levels. And is there any other way that we can make sure that, the programs we're offering compete with the best in the world?
Mr. Giro.
Thank you, Mr. Doss. I'm not really clear about what you mean by what you're trying to achieve. And I'm wondering, is there a strategic plan or a five-year plan, for example, to achieve wherever you're going to? And perhaps whatever you're saying is kind of based on special value on what you're trying to achieve. Talk about money and how much money the school has, and you talk about the university as an individual, as an institution, not talking about the people in the university. What plans do you have for the students? How do you strategize to make us more influential in the society? How do you give us business? How do you give us in better position with business power, with political power? The Ivy League schools, they have that influence in the society. How do you want to achieve that with the student as people? What are your plans with the student? And how do you, because it's not just how much money the university has, it's how much impact the university has on the society.
Couldn't agree more. So I'll put it right back to what are you doing about it? I mean, that's what we're here for. We're here to solve. We're here to build an institution that solves the world's great problems. I can't do it alone. It's not my plan. It's our plan. And, we have to collectively build that institution that's set up to do just that. So everything we do is going to be focused, again, on how we achieve at the highest level, how we produce, we retain, recruit the best students, how we focus on faculties that are making a difference, how we focus on institutes that are solving some of the world's big problems, and how we become known as that voice of reason, respected. I think I saw the word respected. That respected, that when they speak, people listen because we do things right.
What you just say, technically I get that you're trying to do the university as an island and
as an island.
And how do you then bridge that gap between the university and the outside community and organizations outside the community.
I've never used the word island and never will use it.
I didn't say use the word island. That's the idea I'm getting.
It's the wrong idea. You know, we have to work hand-in-hand with all of our stakeholders. That's government, it's taxpayers, it's students, it's industry. We have to be relevant. Increasingly more relevant in everything we do. So to suggest that we're going to do things individually or without, I mean, that's what the whole strategic plan, frankly, is about. That we want people to want to invest in this institution because we are that respected institution that gets things done.
Councilor Farouk?
Thank you again for your time. My question has to do with the board's vision as putting the UFIP forward as a research university. As a university forward as a research institution.
Yeah.
How does that fit in the long-term process, for benefiting students? Like students who just came into the university don't have much of an idea what research would be about and how they would fit in with that vision, as well as how that fits in with the previous question and your response to it as how it relates to the vision and us relating with a better part of the world, business world, and being relevant today.
Yeah. Well, research-intensive universities are incredibly difficult to build, and they're difficult to keep operating at a high level. You constantly have to keep looking at, where are you doing research? Where are you relevant? What's the case for investment for the federal government, the provincial government, for industry to say that, you know, that institution is worthy of investment. So the benefit to the student is that we're able to hopefully attract great minds that either started here and want to stay here or want to come here because they know it's an institution that is focused on solving some of the great issues of our day. And great investigators. I mean, the key tenets of any university, they really serve three functions. One is memory. They preserve the memory of what's gone before. Second is discovery. And the last one is, in my view, is mentorship or leadership. We produce those great citizens. Discovery is a big, big part of it. And, you know, we would hope that we can produce an institution where great researchers, investigators say, we want to come, go there to solve some of the big issues of our day. And that's what creates that momentum, that kind of, I call it a flywheel, builds on itself. It just keeps going faster and faster and faster. We, you know, and with any luck, the best and the brightest in the world want to come here to get on board because this is the place that gets things done. I don't know, did that answer your question?
Sort of? Sort of, yeah.
Good, then I probably did my job, so.
Councilor Zinedine.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, and thank you, Mr. Chairman, for being here. My question is about the U of A's three-year classical online open course, MOOC, Dyno 101. So from my understanding, Dyno 101 had a relatively low number of registrants that actually completed the course, especially as the...
Did you say registrants that completed the course?
That completed.
Okay.
Yeah. So especially as the institution continues to face budgetary pressures next year, will the U of A continue to invest in projects like these, and is this going to be a priority, considering that the U of A has one of the highest student-to-faculty ratios?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. I mean, the whole notion of MOOCs is totally on the table right now. I mean, there's no question the post-secondary world is facing sort of immense disruptive innovation about how knowledge is transferred, how teaching is transferred. MOOCs is just kind of a microcosm of a whole bigger sort of set of issues about how we use, the ability to communicate electronically, to deliver information, and improve our ability to transfer knowledge. Now, the historical, university that had the academic professor who stood up in the front and delivered content for an hour is ridiculous now. I mean, people don't want that, To use a true mentor or leader's time just to deliver content is ridiculous. You can get the content anywhere. part of the classroom is come in and learn and have that feedback and challenge minds and problems and get that interaction going, which really stimulates the mind. And so MOOCs is it's such a wide open question. It's a great question, right? It's a great question about how, you know, if we're really challenging ourselves to be a university that does things as well or better than anybody else, then we have to bring that into the equation. We have to focus the discussion on how we use the ability to communicate electronically to our advantage and deliver great programs more efficiently, and then be able to direct the resources where they really are needed so that we can improve the quality of the programs we deliver. There's so much debate going on all over the world on that, what their future is, and certainly for institutions like ours. I like to lead, but on this one, I'd much rather be a conscientious follower and just see who's going to stub their toe first and learn from it before we make significant mistakes and expend resources, unless we really know it's going to pay some dividends.
Mr. Farouk.
Hi. My name is Wilson Farouk. I'm a student, so I'm a non-member of the Students' Council, so I don't think I can really guess a guest. And thank you so much for coming. We really appreciate people like yourself stepping and making that effort to be interested. There shouldn't be an inquisitorial process as much as it should be a collaborative, engaging process. So in Africa, I kind of have two questions. We talked a lot about leadership, and I really like this paradigm. It's a fascinating paradigm, but I think it's one the university's mandate is a really good one. But I think in part of that, it doesn't necessarily have to go down to dollars and cents. Perhaps there are different ways of managing resources. So for example, I can tell you that the students who are applying for Rhodes Scholarships or Trudeau Fellowships or the Vanier's, the University of Alberta is not necessarily the best place, or it doesn't compare, let's say, to the way the U of S helps mentor their students who are applying for those really prestigious achievement scholarships or something like that.
Yeah.
So when you want to mentor a really prestigious position, when you want to mentor this leadership position, perhaps creating, not necessarily, I know the leadership college is coming, and that's a great thing, but there are perhaps different ways of managing resources that can really work if everyone's willing to kind of listen to each other. Even, and that's the direction that's led from the students. So I think that's one thing. And the second thing that I kind of wanted to ask about was, I know that you're on the Presidential Search Committee. And in that regard, in approaching different people who could give money for writing endowments, I was wondering, in terms of just PR, I really don't care how much the president is paid, but in terms of actually creating a salary cap or lowering the president's salary to just improve the straight-up PR at the university, regardless of the actual function of the university, as an actual step to increasing the university's profile as a leader that's really connected to citizens of Edmonton and to the broader province.
Okay, so you kind of had two questions there. The first one is, I firmly believe that we have to be better on how we support students and how we provide that one-stop shop to help them in the process of student awards and all those things that are there. Because a lot of students don't even know what they qualify, so we have to be better at that. The second question was
In terms of when you're bringing on
you're talking about presidential. Sorry, yeah. Okay, so I mean, it's a difficult issue, but I can tell you this. Okay, this is a $2 billion operation. Whoever we hire isn't coming here because of the salary. I'll guarantee you that. I don't care if it's $200,000. I don't care if they're coming for nothing. Or $400,000 or $1 million. They're still not coming here because of the salary. Anybody who's worth their weight in salt are coming here because this is an institution that's got a platform that's going someplace, and they see their ability to be part of that change, part of that powerful force that's going to affect some real change in the world. That's why they're coming here. It's got nothing to do with the dollars. And so whether it's $200,000 or $300,000 or $400,000, we set a minimum cap. Mainly because we have to comply with international rules now on recruitment. And this is a true global search. There's people applying from all over the world, which is a good thing. they're saying this is a university that, frankly, is in a position to do some things that are pretty spectacular over the next 10 years, and they want to be part of it. But we also, you know, if we're saying we're going to be a university that competes with the best of people, we don't want to insult people either. We want to actually set the standard within a range that we know is within a range of what you would pay somebody who's responsible for a $2 billion operation that we want to take to $3 billion and beyond. So one of the things that gets frustrating to me, and this isn't generally about universities, but we as a people, as a society, as Albertans, need to aspire to achieve at high levels. That means push. And if people are achieving at high levels and being successful, then that's great. That's what we want. You know, this isn't a race to the bottom. It's not a race to mediocrity. We're trying to go to the top. Don't apologize for that.
And again, just for clarification, it's not some sort of moral objection to the salary. It's rather a fundamental marketing PR perspective.
I understand.
There's so much criticism of it.
Listen, you know, there are some who might be in the world who would say, I'll come and work there for a dollar because I don't need the money and I just want the job. And it's entirely possible. We might get somebody like that. But we're also sensible enough that we're going to set a range that we know is at least in the tier that we are saying that we see ourselves as a university that competes with the best in the world and want to compensate accordingly.
Yes, Councillor Cruzzi.
So in light of the fact that there are several speakers remaining on the list and the chair has been more than kind enough to engage us in this meaningful discussion, if the chair is amenable to it, I'd like to make a motion that we continue to extend the question period until the questions on the list have been answered.
How many more do we have?
It's 9 more on here, but there's also one additional person who I just told her name, so 10 more people. We can cut it off at the end, at 10 people if you'd like. Or
yeah, let's do that because it's true. I actually have a date tonight with my wife, so.
All right, so we'll cut the speakers list off here, basically. But I'll still continue with giving priority to people who have not had a chance to answer or ask questions yet. So, is there a seconder for the motion, by the way? Councillor Ferg, is there anyone opposed to carrying this motion? Wonderful. So we'll keep going with Councillor Champagne.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, and thank you very much for taking time on a special night here to come.
I'm going through a whole jug of water. So
yeah. Come talk to us and answer our questions. My question goes like this. Alumni contributions are not only an important source of funding, but they also contribute to the spirit of the institution and help create a positive feedback cycle that assists the institution in growing both in size and in quality. What is the trend in the current alumni contributions? How do they compare to past years? And are students satisfied when they leave this institution to the point of believing that they want to give back to it in their future, to the point where they believe that this is the institution to give their dollars to?
They all leave as Michael Bloombergs.
And if not, how do we get them there?
That's it. You just answer your question. I mean, it's, you know, we do want. I mean, have we been better? Absolutely. We put in place methods over the last number of years where we're much better at talking to our alumni the day they become alumni, which is frankly the day they start here on their first day, and how we follow them through their careers. So we're much, much better at that. And alumni contributions have, by number, have gone up dramatically. And that's a function of just staying in contact with them. But, you know, it's true. People put their money where their mouth is. And if they really believe, they have to really believe that it's an institution that's making a difference. That's what's good. You can talk about loyalty, about, I love the Bears, I love the Pandas, and all the rest of the stuff, and that's my alma mater for life, and all the rest of it. But they also want to be proud of the institution that they're really achieving some things that are special in the world. That's ultimately going to be what bring people back and say, I'm Michael Bloomberg, here's $1 billion. I believe that this is the best investment I can make. Not just in my city, in my state, but in humanity. That's the ultimate test to me that you've done well as an institution. Thank you.
Mr. Soltykevich, hopefully I pronounced that.
No, close enough. If someone gave you a blank check, but you had to decide one section of the university, as you mentioned, getting the higher standards of excellence, getting in a top university, if you could make it, whether it's investing in better professors, spend more money on getting top professors from across the world, whether it's infrastructure, building more buildings for more students to be able to come to this university, or if it would be special projects, be it having students go to Cortona or study abroad across the world, be it like engineers abroad, be it the leadership college, what would you kind of invest and where would you put that?
I can't answer that because it's everything, right?
Yeah.
It's not any one thing. The real question is where are we best suited, given all the things we have, to take what we do to another level? And how do we build around that? My own notion would be right now we're long on infrastructure and buildings and short on people. That means professors, that means...
The numbers, or like they're... Do we don't have enough professors? Do you think
I don't think we have enough professors, absolutely. And we also need to focus on those areas where we know we have some strategic advantages. And, you know, we've seen it on the medical side. There's some great things going on in virology. Michael Houghton's doing some things with the Hep C virus and now on the vaccine. You know, interesting, you know, as a country... Israel has put more companies on NASDAQ than any other country in the world since the year 2000 than the United States. Here's this little country, 7 million people, people shooting out from both sides, they don't have any resources, but they focused their institutions to produce and solve some of the world's great problems. They're doing it at a very high level. You know, the country of Canada has produced one Nobel Prize in medicine since 1992, Michael Smith at UBC, the whole flipping country. So when you talk about resources, we've got to look about where we can really build some on an increasingly competitive global stage, where we can really focus and achieve at high levels. So we got lots of work to do. It really is, and it starts at. And it's at every level, but it's about pushing, and never relentlessly pursuing that.
Councillor Kruse.
So thanks for giving us your time this evening. I hope that you have a lovely date afterwards.
I'll report back later. I'll let you report back.
So you mentioned that the university is facing some funding deficit and cuts in the face of a provincial surplus. And in the agenda, the change agenda, you mentioned that the Board of Governors...
We did last year. Not this year.
Misunderstanding. The change agenda mentioned that you'll develop a set of decision-making principles to apply to developing a sustainable budget. And the Board of Governors kind of sits at a unique spot between the government of Alberta and the University of Alberta. So I'm wondering, I have three questions focused around that. So first of all, what are some of the tangible strategies that the Board of Governors will use to advocate for and convince the government to increase funding of U of A? Number two, how can you convince U of A to use these funds appropriately to benefit the institution as well as the students here? And third, what can student leaders do to help have an influence or impact on that?
Well, listen, I wouldn't be the board chair of this university if I didn't believe that an investment in post-secondary is a sound investment for this province. So we advocate at the very highest levels of government on that basis. We had that nauseam last year in the face of what we thought were you know, building great institutions is all about momentum. You're either going this way or you're going that way. And when you, if you start going that way, it's really hard to turn it around. And we don't want to stall. It's the last thing we want to do. And I started out this conversation by talking about the opportunities we have as a province to really do something special in the world, because we've been giving those resources to do so, to do just that. So, you know, we advocate for government at the highest possible levels, and those are great investments. Students can, you're part of the institution, it's not just the government. In fact, you got two governors on our board. We rely on everybody to push and talk about the, you know, why an investment in you guys is going to pay dividends, you know, for decades to come, and why those investments are worth every penny of taxpayers' money and industry's money and our alumni philanthropy money and all those investments. Those are, that's all our job, is to continue to say these are the drivers of great societies, great institutions like these. Our job is to make sure we run them properly and that, that the piece for investment continues to be sound.
Ms. Karunakaran.
Thank you for speaking with us today. It's been a really good discussion. And I really liked your earlier presentation when you made the comparison to the University of Waterloo. I think they have a great engineering faculty, and I think we have a great engineering faculty too. But one of the things that plagues us, like many of the other faculties here, is that we have really large class sizes, and each year we have more and more students coming into the university and wanting to join engineering. And I think in a response to a similar question earlier, you said we can find space, we can find space in these faculties, in these programs. And so, you know, with large group class sizes, I think it's hard for engineers to achieve those high levels of performance that you were speaking about. Engineering is a standardized profession, so it's very possible to produce sort of like mediocre engineers that just, you know, sort of work. And in order to produce, you know, have graduates that can achieve strongly in Alberta, my question, I guess, is how do we find space in our programs? And if we do find space, how do we make that space meaningful? How do we have a higher quality of education so that that space, those programs, those individuals that join us have a meaningful experience and they can contribute positively to, you know, our province?
Wow, that's a great question. Dave Ledger never say he produces mediocre engineers. So. but, you know, again, it's, I can't answer any of the specifics of that. All I can say is, and I know Dave Lynch is, you know, finely attuned to this. I know he can tell you how each and every one of the departments in engineering stack up against our peers, what those metrics are, and what it's going to take to go from here to the next level. And I expect part of those metrics in his world are class sizes and all those other things. So I know he's done a remarkable job of building a tremendous engineering faculty. The challenge for Dave's successor, because Dave's, well, going to be retiring next year, is to keep that momentum and, you know, keep moving those metrics in the right direction. So of all the things you're talking about, you can come back here a year from now and say, we're getting better. So you've got to keep pushing. We don't have a question for that.
Mr. Muhammad.
Can you go to the section 2014-2015 budget sections? It's on page 159. I should say at the bottom of each page. It's 159. Yeah, so before I ask my question, it's about the international differential fee. Point 3 over there, I don't know if you could zoom in so that people can see point 3, but it says that the budget assumption is a 1% increase in general tuition fees, graduate student international differential fee, and effective 5% increase in undergraduate international student tuition. You mentioned that you didn't know anything about a differential fee being increased, but it says in the university's comprehensive institutional plan that it's going to be increased again. And I get very emotional.
Are you talking about the international student fee?
But I get very emotional about this because I see a lot of international students suffering from the other 5% increase, and I honestly feel like I'm being lied to right now and in the past. So can you please explain that? And also, can you please...
Well, I thought this was what was approved last year. Sorry.
No, this is 2014-2015 budget assumption, so this year. So can you promise to vote against. Right now, promise they will vote against.
Wasn't this what was approved in December? This is new stuff. This is what
this
was approved.
Passed June 2014. It's on the VP academic.
Yeah. Oh, this is what we voted on in December.
Yeah. It was approved. It's in the plan.
That's what we approved.
I disagree.
That's what we approved.
Point of parliamentary inquiry.
Yes.
I don't think you're correct.
Point of parliamentary inquiry, Mr. Speaker. Generally, budget assumptions, from my understanding, that are voted at the Board of Governors for December and or January are made for the following fiscal year. Am I correct?
I honestly can't speak to that because I'm not a member of the Board of Governors, so I can't say whether that's true or not. I'll take the word of the members of the Board of Governors.
You can't put in place differential increases retroactively, so it wasn't. You can't be for 2015-14. We're already in that year. That what was approved. What was approved at the governors' meetings was a 5% increase for this coming year. That's what we budgeted on. So
can you promise that you'll vote against any differential?
I cannot promise that. I won't promise that. I promise you we'll look at all the issues. And before we approve something like that, we'll make sure that it makes sense, in every sense, from the vision of a university that sees itself competing with the best in the world. So, there's a whole debate on this, by the way. I was just talking to the search firm we're using for our presidential search, Paralabor, and they do searches all over the world. Monash University, Melbourne, Australia. They have 70,000 students, 20,000 of which are international students. The differential between what they charge their international students is like sixfold compared to what they charge their Aussie students. And the president says unabashedly, it's the policy we follow here because, frankly, our demand is high. We charge international students through the nose, but it pays for our Aussies to go to school. It pays for us to do world-class research. They don't even apologize for it. I'm not saying we're going to go there. What I'm saying is you have to look at the whole world and make sure that when you're making decisions, you're making them on the basis that you do are true to your notion that you're an institution that competes with the best in the world. All those factors go into it. It's not any one thing. But they all add up to whether or not you're making the right decisions for the right reasons. And that, I can assure you, that we will make decisions on the right reasons. And if it doesn't make sense, we won't do it. But if it does make sense in the context of what we're trying to achieve as an institution and as one of the tools that's helping us get there, then we will do it. We'll do the right thing.
Mr. Rothman.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Thank you again, Chairman Dacos, for taking so much time. I know that this question period is probably gone over, but everybody expects it to be in terms of length. My question, again, ties back to your presentation about how you talked about solving global issues and being relevant to our community. There are a lot of opportunities for students to achieve that outside of the classroom when it comes to volunteering with the Students Union or the Faculty Association or other relevant student groups on campus. And I was just wondering, when it comes to drafting the university strategic plan, the academic plan, what role do you see the Students Union or other student groups playing in developing the major bigger, smaller problems in the world?
So we have spoken about that is what we do. So that's what we all need to be doing is engaged in the notion that we're producing and care about producing leaders who want to make a difference. Volunteerism, giving back, all of those things are are measurements of societies that care about themselves and care about helping those vulnerable that need help. Be the international students that are facing financial distress, whatever it is, right? That's what great institutions do. They solve those problems, and they produce students and leaders that give a damn. They want to get in and make a difference. That's what leadership by example. That's what that's all about. It's creating that culture that this is important to do. I've kind of lived my life that way. I mean, that's what I believe.
Mr. Kim.
Okay, thank you again for being here on the romantic date.
it's getting less and less romantic.
So there has
been a lot of controversy and rumors about the Faculty of Business and Department of Fine Arts moving to downtown on, under the name of the Galleria project.
Yeah.
So I was wondering what's the progress on this file, and wondering when will students and the general public will have an opportunity to partake in the public consultation slash discussion.
Well, the notion of the Galleria project did go to the Board of Governors, and it was approved on conditions that we would entertain moving into the downtown, a whole bunch of conditions. Those conditions included that we'd be part of a vibrant downtown campus. We didn't want to have an isolated campus that wasn't connected to the university, that we could program it properly. And there's a whole series of conditions that related to any potential movement. As I understand it, the folks, because the gallery is not, it's really important to understand the gallery is not the university's project. It's a project that's being led by a group of philanthropists in the private sector in Edmonton who want to do something for arts and culture and really define Edmonton as an arts and cultural capital for the city. So it makes sense to the extent the university can participate in that and be part of this community that we would entertain on the right conditions, such a campus. And as I understand it, the city council is now, in Edmonton, has now approved the first sort of phase of that. We can't do anything without the province signs the checks for any capital that we would be part of. So they would actually have to sign the operating grant, which will allow us to sign a lease to move into the downtown. That's well down the road. But the fundamentals of it have already gone to the Board of Governors. They've already approved that we would move downtown subject to those conditions, and if you're interested in those conditions, they're a matter of public record.
Councillor Jang.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is regarding the Leadership College. I am wondering if the university attempted to receive a biased feedback by piloting the Leadership College to the business faculty, knowing that that specific demographic might receive more positivity to the leadership program compared to, let's say, a liberal arts student or a bio sci student? And if not, what was the reasoning behind piloting the leadership program only to business students?
Honestly, I don't know the exact genesis of it, but my understanding of the genesis of the leadership program is that it was a group of, I think, the Fergusons who philanthropically saw this as a program that made sense, and they worked in partnership with the Dean of Business to make it happen. So I don't think there was sort of a direct a bias or anything around this. That's certainly nothing I'm aware of. Do you have any information on that?
No one of first donors. I'm meeting with Josephine Doucette.
But it wasn't a conscious sort of decision of some kinds.
Councillor Sleeman.
Thank you. You have spoken about our strength as a university, but what would you say is our biggest weakness that they deserve to grow with their class completion or role? How can you work on that?
I think the biggest thing for us to do is recognize that we're only limited by our own sort of ambition and creativity, and that we can do so much more collectively if we work together with common visions and build those constructs that allow us to reach out and do things together with a common vision to achieve the things that define an excellent institution. That's what we've got to be better at. We've managed to become a relatively decentralized institution for faculties, often run quite independently of each other. And if we can ever get our act together, we're all working constructively and putting the university first, not necessarily a program or a person or a faculty ahead of the collective goal of the institution. I think that we've got an opportunity to do some really, really special things.
And with the last question, Councillor Zhang.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. So the university often discusses using market modifiers to ensure that as an institution, we are fiscally aligned with the pace that we are at. And I'm wondering, would you personally be for or against applying a sort of market modifier to the salaries of our senior administration to ensure that that is also in line with our institution?
Putting market modifiers on
the salaries of our senior administration, so the vice president.
Listen, I've answered that question the same way I've answered the question of presidential salaries. You know, we want to be fair. We don't want to be ridiculous. We're stewards of the public's money. We have to do things responsibly. So what we don't want to be is a stupid. We don't want to be outrageous. We don't want to be stewards of the public's money where people are saying, what the hell are they doing? Look what they're doing. I mean, that's not what we should be doing. You know, for an institution as large as this one, as complex as this one, you know, 50,000 people either go to school here or go to work here every day. It's a huge, huge responsibility to keep this thing running. If there's anything I get worried about is that we don't put enough investment in people on the administrative side to make sure we're taking full advantage of making sure this place is run efficiently. I'm not for paying people too much money. I am for making sure we have enough people to get it right.
I think that's the last question. Again, on behalf of council, thank you so much for coming. You know, I've been on council for 4 years. I've never seen someone that's as senior as yourself spend an hour and a half here. And I think one thing that as councilors we're going to be moving forward is to understand what the Board of Governors says. I will be doing a presentation of exactly the roles and responsibility of a board, and maybe that'll help to further define the roles. But I've worked with Doug now for a few months, and every time I have a question, he responds to me very quickly. And Doug and all the Board of Governors that I've met, I've met with most of them by now, and they really do want to build a world class institution, an institution that competes internationally. And with that, they really do care about students, and they want to improve the value of our degree and give us the best experience possible. And I'm excited to work with Doug. I know Willie is as well to help work to get there through this year. So thank you very much, Doug, for coming.
All right, so with that, we'll end the presentation. In addition to Governor Hatchett's comments, for all those who are not members of Students' Council, who are not acting as proxies, thank you for taking the time to come out and engage with the board chair. As the speaker, it's very my 2 years on Students' Council, I don't think I've seen council chambers this full of non-members of Students' Council, so thank you very much for taking the time to actually engage with the board chair. With that, we'll move on with the rest of our agenda, so you are free to leave or stay. It doesn't really matter. If you'd like to continue to take part in Students' Council, feel free to. Before I move on to agenda item 7A, just wanted to make a quick note. I didn't want to take up too much time before the presentation, but something I forgot to do earlier is council scholarship forms. So there are forms available at the front here where the main agenda and late edition packages are for nominations of members of Students' Council for a sponsorship of $500. So feel free to grab them. I don't believe any member of the executive can be nominated, so don't nominate them or I'll just throw it out. Technically, it's supposed to be in by the end of the night, but just because we're on a gave it to you just now, I guess, I'll probably give you about a week to hand them in, so we'll say next Monday at 11:59 p.m. I think is a fair time. So scan them in if you can. Send them to me by email. Send them to Nicole by email. If you can't scan them, I'll figure out a way to pick up paper copies. So, yes, Also, the next meeting of Students' Council will take place on Tuesday, August 19th, 2014. Yes, Vice President.
Do we have a break for recess after 9 minutes?
Technically, we could, but at the same time, I don't see a presentation as being an item of business. So I'll... I don't count that as an item of business. If council wants to do that, we can do that. But we can also do a quick nomination to NomCom and then move on to a recess. Sounds like council wants to break, so we'll break for 15 minutes. Reconvene at 7:56 p.m.
Oh, really?
Wow,
Right. Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh,
All right. Reconvene. Please take your seats. All right. Sorry, Nicole. All right, we'll move on to item 7A from the late editions. Bannister moves to appoint one member of Students' Council to the nominating committee. Is there a seconder for this particular motion? Councillor Zhang?
I second that.
Yes, I know you're seconding that. All right, so, Councillor Bannister, would you like to introduce?
Sure. So, most of you probably know what nominating committee does. Basically, if there's an opening of student representative seats on campus, they send it to nominating committee, and we kind of sort through all the applications and fill those spots. So, we meet off council Tuesdays from 5:30 to 6:30 during the summer, but it will likely change in September. And it's fun.
Who's on the committee? So don't nominate those people.
All good people.
All right, so any points of information, requests for information from Councillor Bannister? Not, we'll move on to nominations. Are there any nominations? Councillor Bannister, yes.
I'd like to nominate Councillor Allard.
Councillor Allard, do you accept?
I do.
Mr. Kim?
I'd like to nominate Councillor Zhang.
Councillor Zhang, do you accept?
Nope.
Are there any further nominations? Seeing none, congratulations, Councillor Allard. Okay. All right, so moving on. Move on to... Item 3, Executive Committee Reports. Do any members of the Executive wish to make a report? Seeing none, continue. Move on to item 4, Board and Committee Reports. Do any committee chairs or Board of Governors representative wish to make a report? Seeing none, move on to question period. All right, we'll start with the question that was on the late editions, that was from Councillor Bannister to Vice President Diaz. Why can't Red Bull operate on campus? Vice President Diaz.
Mr. Speaker, Red Bull cannot operate on campus because we have a single switch that we can do with Coca-Cola. It says that we cannot allow external companies to promote, advertise, or appear to collaborate with the University of Alberta or the University of Alberta Student Union. So they could work with us as long as they didn't show their logos, hang out with us, or give us anything.
Okay.
We need nothing.
Yeah. Is there any follow-up, Councillor Bannister?
So did they, like, approach you and were like, we would like to do this, and you said no?
They asked to go talk to my boss, and I said no.
Okay. Good job. Okay.
All right. Wonderful. Any other questions for question period? Oh, Councillor Sleeman.
Questions for VP Kim. On your report, you say that associations come together to discuss a lot of the big picture items that are happening. What do you mean by big picture?
Sorry, is it under a clause?
Where in her report does she write that?
We had a meeting at Mount Royal University, and we also had one of our like actual meetings where we discuss certain agenda items and talk about big picture items that are happening. And essentially, this is just a recap of, as I mentioned in my course before, a lot of the stuff that's happening with the ministry right now is that various departments, such as Advanced Ed, are having consultations with stakeholders. So that includes students, that includes board presidents and all that. Consultations on things that include like best practices for institutions, definition of fees. So that's what I mean by big picture, instead of listing each thing out. I've discussed it a bit before. Essentially, as we all know, the government wants to reform campus Alberta. And they're working on a lot of different initiatives right now, and so that's putting a lot of work on our plates because, you know, it's a great thing to be consulting students. It just means that we have to keep talking to all of our stakeholders as well and figuring out what points we want to talk about. So hopefully that answers your question, but probably not get more. Yep.
Thank you very much, Vice President Kinda. Councillor Zhang.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. This question is for President Lau. Sorry. I wanted to ask if he, a couple meetings ago, said that he would approach the Honorable Kim Campbell to come speak at Council regarding the Peter Lougheed Leadership College. I'm wondering if he's done that, or if he's planning to do that eventually.
President Lau. Thank you, Councillor Zhang, for the question. You're right, I did make that promise that I had yet to follow up with Honorable Kim Campbell. The last conversation we have had was with acting provost anymore, but Martin Ferguson Hill as the president's advisor on the Leadership College. And he did commit to a presentation perhaps in September, October. But we will discuss that when the committee reconvenes, probably beginning of September.
Councillor Zhang.
So, will the president be approaching Kim Campbell to ask her to come to council to speak regarding the college?
Sure, why not?
Councillor Wong.
I'd like to yield a question to a student of letters from the help.
Sure.
This question is directed towards VP Academic because it's her portfolio. This is about the Leadership College. Since the plans have changed radically, is the SU going to withdraw its support from the Leadership College? Is there any consideration to be done?
Vice President Ortzik.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Our stance in the Leadership College going forward is not to say no to it, but rather to say yes, but. So we will support as long as we have continued involvement when we find out what the programming is, continued consultation on the various ways in which they will interact in already existing leadership programming, as well as our input on the way in which they will impact as many students as humanly possible.
Just a very quick follow-up.
I don't have anyone else on my speakers.
Oh, okay.
Go ahead.
That'll still be quick. Do you know when the university is going to come up with a plan? Because they still don't have a plan about how they're going to
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The committee with all the stakeholders on it, POLCAC, it will start up again in September. I am expecting a plan at the first or second meeting of POLCAC, and I am meeting with them one-on-one to try to let them know what we want out of these things. But once I know, you will know. Do not worry.
Councillor Sleeman.
This question is for Governor Hansen. I was wondering what you thought about the presentation.
Governor Hansen.
He's not directing water. You know, I think there was a lot of good questions asked. There was a lot of solid questions asked. I'm going to get point of order here, but some of the stuff that was said was just absolutely stupid. And for undergraduate students to be here and to call someone a liar, especially a guy, you know, who's dedicated so much of his time and commitment to the University of Alberta, and especially when you don't know the facts, seriously, like, how do you expect administrators to come to council and listen to us if we can't ask reasonable questions? Do you guys have a hard time? It was extremely hard to get in on the conditions he wanted. And it's a shame that some students took so much liberty and extended, and I would argue were malicious, you know, and potentially ruined negotiations and their just willingness to come to council for generations. This guy, Doug Goss, is not our enemy, right? The administrator, sure, we can go after them, but Doug Goss is our friend, right? He is, you know, there's issues. If there's been issues with students being able to communicate with the Board of Governors, it's the Board of Governors representatives and the president's fault. It's our own students' fault. It's not his fault. We have to do a better job of communicating our issues, right? You don't go attacking the guy who came here willing to answer any questions. You don't call the guy a liar. Like, seriously, you know, and you are here to represent students. You have a fiduciary responsibility to represent students. Do your job. Show leadership. How do you expect him or the administration to take us seriously when we ask stupid questions like that?
Governor Hanser, just...
Sorry. So, going forward, I hope council, shows more tact. And if we're careful in their line of questioning, we need these people to come to council so we can do our job and effectively communicate with them, not push them away. So that's all I'll say.
Before I move on to anything else, I remind council, make sure you do not attack an individual personally. It's completely out of order. And that's all I'm going to say about it. So please refrain from doing so. Not, I will remove you from chambers next time. So keep that in mind. Moving forward. Any other questions? Yes, Councillor Horvat.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is for VP Ops 5. I'm just wondering, because you met with the Alumni Association in terms of the Power Plant project, just wondering if the Alumni Association will be donating or contributing to any of the plans for that project.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, and thank you for the question, Councilor, for that. It's hard to say right now. This is still in the very, very preliminary stage. Obviously, that would be a great source of funding the project. I guess kind of the biggest question to answer right now with our involvement with the Alumni Association is they're also planning on creating a alumni center on campus. And so really the question right now is is it one project or is it two projects, the North Power Plant and the Alumni Center, or is there a way that these projects can kind of be the same thing? So that's what we're going to be moving forward in conversations about. If they are the same thing, I think there will be some contributions from them, but it's really way too early to say at this point. I'm hoping to have a better idea of the alumni involvement and probably
not yet. Councillor Cruzzi.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I'm curious, this question is for student at large, Bashir Muhammad. I'm curious what Bashir thought about the presentation by Bashir.
Point of order, Mr. Speaker.
I'm not sure a question can be directed to a student at large, so let me review standing orders. But I don't think that question is in order. There's nothing in standing orders that limits that, but just because Mr. Muhammad is not a member of Students' Council, I won't be allowing the question. I also won't be allowing you to ask the question to somebody else so that they can defer to Mr. Muhammad to answer the question, if that makes sense. I'm assuming that was your question, so
yeah. We'll
move on. Councillor Zhang.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. This question is for Vice President of Operations and Finance. For my own benefit, can the Vice President go over again why we are choosing to put a coffee shop on the lower level of services?
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Speaker, and thank you, Councillor Zhang, for the question. So this was on recommendation from the consultants we hired in the renovation process. We need a food and beverage outlet in order to activate the space to kind of drive students and drive populace there to have people in the space. So what we wanted to do was to do something tried and true, something a business model we're comfortable with running. We opened daily grind last year, and it's done incredibly well, exceeded basically all the expectations we had for it, so we know that's a good model moving forward. Obviously, there is some issue of duplicating the service we're offering, but the goal here in opening this coffee shop is not to make tons and tons of money. It's not all of our businesses. The goal is always to maximize profit. Like L'Express, for example, sure we could charge more money for what we offer, but the goal there is to provide a food source that is cheaper on average for students. So it's a service we're providing there. So again, the goal with the coffee shop is not to try to rake in all the cash we can. It's to activate that space and to bring students into it. So I have no issues with it as it stands right now. I think just based off of how Daily Grind has done, and which has been doing quite well, we're mimicking some of that those qualities as well as offering some new things there. I believe it'll succeed, but we will be following. I will be following up on it throughout the year.
Do I have a follow up?
Mr. Siltikiewicz.
Question would be, in regards to the power plant situation, will you be starting up another business advisory group?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Speaker, and thank you, Mr. Siltikiewicz.
Siltikiewicz.
Okay. I'm going to start it again, and it's actually going to be called SMART this time. Name. It stands for Student Market Research Team. So, whereas before we had the process was much more sit down, have a conversation with the manager about some of the things we think, I would like to have a more multi-step process where the manager kind of comes up with a series of questions or things they want to know. What do students expect to pay for a pint of beer? What kind of beers do they like? Basically, just general, any specific market information they want to know about their consumers, about the students who frequent these places. The student market research team will then conduct market research, surveys, focus groups, polls, to collect that information. We'll come back, have a discussion similar to what we had before, but data-driven, and to look at anything that comes out of the data or see where some problems are, where some opportunities lie, discuss possible changes, implement those changes, and then go and measure the effect. See that was the response the one we wanted? Did what we expect to happen or something else? And we'll work on that kind of process on a semesterly basis. So yeah, we'll be starting up again. I will be advertising spots late August, I think. So if you're interested, I believe you were on Bang last year. Yeah. Definitely reapply. We'll be working again on duties and likely submark this time around.
Awesome, thanks.
So the first 15 minutes of question period has elapsed. We'll move on unless I see 5 placards. I currently have 3 people on my speakers list. All right. So moving on, I have Councillor Horvat with her follow-up question potentially.
Going back to the power plant, how likely is it for you guys to share the building in terms of an alumni center with the power plant? Also, I don't remember if you wrote in your report about whether the GC is involved with the power plant, and have you had talks or discussions, or will they be involved with it?
Just before Vice President Hodgson moves on with his answer, a reminder, councillors, make sure you limit your questions to 1 question, not 3 or 4 or 18. So, Vice President Hodgson.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, and thank you, Councillor Horvat, for the question. How likely involved with the Alumni Center? No idea. I had our first meeting with them. Sean Price was very enthusiastic about the project, but there's a lot of work to be done still to find out what exactly it's going to look like in the end. As for collaborations with the GSA, absolutely. I've had a few meetings with my counterpart, Mega Vajra, already, the VP Student Services of the Graduate Students Association, and we'll continue working more or less as hand in hand on this project. The next big step for me is drafting a visioning document for the project and to get alumni in the GSA to sign off on it, and they will be going through multiple revisions with both parties.
Councilor Farouk.
My question is towards VP Austin as well. In light of the coffee shop on the underground, a lot of other businesses are going to be located on the bottom floor.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, and thank you, Councilor Farouk, for the question. So currently, Subprint, which was previously located on the lower level, is still there, but in a new retail bay, much more front-facing, much more open and accessible and visible. As well, we have another retail bay that is currently empty. We went out to RFP for it, and we're not happy with the response that we got from the market. So the current plan is to wait until the renovations are finished, and the lower level atrium is completed. We have beautiful daylight streaming into that space to go back to RFP, because at that point, we believe people will be able to see actually how beautiful that space is going to be, how high traffic it's going to be, and we believe we'll get a much better response that time around through our RFP process.
Do you have a follow-up question? Or you ready?
I'll put you on the speaker's list. If you guys want to follow up, just tell me, and I'll put you at the end of the speaker's list. Councilor Zhang.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. So this is my follow-up with VP Opsify, and this question comes from me having worked in contracting and having drafted RFQs and RFPs. I am wondering if there was a discussion with the consultants under the notion that the business is intended to liven up the space on the second the basement. And I'm wondering if there's a discussion regarding the fact that perhaps...
I'd remind Councillor Zhang that you can only ask one question at a time.
Yes, this is one question. This is a long one.
Make sure it's only one question, not two, just a run-on sentence question.
Okay. Was there a discussion regarding the fact that having a duplicate business may not attract students to the space due to the fact that that business already exists on the first floor? Was there a discussion around that with the consultants or with any marketing consultants?
Is that clear as mud?
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, and thank you, Councillor Zhang. I'll be honest, that process took place before my time in office. I don't believe it'll... the goal is not to draw students into the space so much as have services there that they can access. Like, I don't believe by having a duplicated service, it'll take away from that. I'm trying to think of a way to explain this. In accessing a space, when you go somewhere, because it'll have kind of cafe style seating and lounge style seating nearby, and that's the goal, is to get students to be there and to stay there to occupy the space, as opposed to draw them in. Like if you were going for a coffee and just want to grab a coffee and quickly run out, then Daily Grind is your place to go. It's easy, it's accessible. But if you want to sit in the sunlight and read a book or something, you have that amenity right beside you as well. It's to add more value to the location. So it's not just a great space to lounge. There's also access to service immediately situated.
Thank you.
Councillor Bannister.
I have a question for Vicky also. It's your day. So I know last year her bag was turning into SMART. It was made up of representatives that were predominantly from one faculty, and it wasn't that even amongst all the different faculties. So is any effort going to be put into this year to make sure that what's going to be called SMART is going to have representation from all its different stakeholders of the university?
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, and thank you, Councillor Bannister, for the question. As a science student, I very much agree with that sentiment. I don't want to try to, I mean, if we have, say, 10 phenomenal art students apply, I don't want to bias too much based off faculty with almost affirmative action with faculties, but I will not rank one faculty higher than another, because I think, especially because it will be focused around this research aspect, many faculties provide the opportunity for students to develop research skills, and that's what we'll be looking for primarily there.
Councilor Farouk.
Following up with what you were saying about the other businesses, apology that this might be too much. What kind of response did you get, and what were you looking for?
Only one question.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, and thank you, Councillor Farouk, for the question. Response, poor. What we were hoping for, a lot better. We try to remember exactly. I think we came back with a dentist, and we thought having a frontward, outward-facing retail bay to one of the main entrances of Sub, which will have a plaza with seating in it. It'll have all like Florida glass or floor-to-ceiling glass windows, daylight streaming in. We don't want to. A dentist is not the first thing you want to see when you walk into the students' union building. I hate the dentist. It creeps me out when I go there. But so really, we had a number of different sectors we were targeting in the RFP. I can't list them all off the top of my head, but I can get that information for you if you want. But like I said, like really, really poor response. So one of the issues is we have not done a lot of retail in our building, tenant-wise. So we're hoping we will be bringing in some tenants. Bijan Optical is going in the Juicy space just beside the stairs to the second floor. We're hoping with putting retail in the building now, we can show that the Students' Union building is not only good for food operations. We did limit that space. We didn't allow food and beverage to apply. We wanted a retail bay there. So we're hoping with showcasing that Bijan Optical does well as a retail outlet in the Students' Union building, we'll have a better retail response.
All right, that exhausts my speakers list, so we'll move on from question period. We'll move on to item 6A, Kinda Grulke, on the recommendation of Policy Committee, move to approve the mandatory non-instructional fee policy in second reading. The principles are listed here, and the policy is attached as item 14-07-0.02, sorry. Quick edit that was brought to my attention in the third, and I guess in the second beat, further resolve that clause, or the third bird clause. Please eliminate the add footnote.
Point of personal privilege?
Yes.
That is a counselor's reading.
Yeah.
I was just trying to make a motion from the floor.
Yes.
So I'm trying to make a motion that student at large, Mr. Mohammed, be allowed 3 minutes to speak.
I'm not sure if that motion. I don't. I've never heard of such a motion. So just give me a second to review Robert's rules. And
okay, I'll advocate to make a motion to suspend standing orders for 3 minutes.
I don't even know if it's in standing orders, so I'll have to review both these items. Just give me one moment.
Hold on.
Because we were already talking about, we were already into debate sort of on the motion, what is it, 6A, I think it was. I'm not going to allow the motion, but I will tell the counselor that he can raise the motion before item 6B and after item 6A, in which case I would recommend to... I'm not really sure. Probably suspend standing orders, something like that. I'm not sure how I'm going to rule, to be honest. And I strongly encourage people to challenge my position because it's not something that's very well defined in Robert's rules or in our standing orders. So feel free to challenge or do whatever you'd like to do. But I'm just going to move on with item 6A, and after then you can make your motion. So like I was saying... item 6A, there's a quick edit to the attached item. So under the third bird clause, please note that add footnote has been removed. Other than that, I'll allow Vice President Kinda to introduce.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Good evening, Council. So for you, you have the second reading of the Mandatory Non-Instructional Fee Policy. In the agenda, it has the first principles that were passed last meeting, and these principles are what we based the new policy on. So policy committee had a really good and long discussion about the whereas clauses, about the be it resolved clauses. So hopefully you find this is a good representation of the principles, and I'm looking forward to debate. Thanks.
All right, we'll move into debate. Does anyone wish to discuss this item? Councillor Bannister.
I'd like to speak in favor of this. I am on a policy committee, and there was a very in-depth discussion. Many avenues were looked at. So yes, I'll be voting in favor of this.
Thank you, Councillor Bannister. Is there any further debate? Is there anyone who would like to speak against this motion? Would there be any opposition to this carrying this motion unanimously? Do you want me to reread the motion?
No. Do you want a minute to read it?
Did everyone get a chance to read the policy? I don't know if Councilor Fruk is saying that because he didn't read it or because he doesn't think everyone else read it. I'll allow Council the remainder of this time, 3 minutes, to read policy. Please take the time to read it if you haven't read it already. This wouldn't happen if you guys had read the information beforehand.
If you have questions, just ask them. I'll ask them all at once. Once again, I will ask, is there anyone who is opposed to carrying this motion unanimously? Yes, Councillor Allard, you have a question.
I've never proposed an amendment, so doing that
You absolutely, you can propose an amendment right now.
I would like to propose an amendment, and I'm hesitant to bring up too much debate here because I think the policy as it is very strong. But in the "be it for the result" clause, the University of Alberta Students' Union advocate for a student approval mechanism for the implementation of a new mandatory non-instructional fees, as well as for an increase to existing mandatory non-instructional fees. I would like to amend increase to change to reflect the possibility of the university removing the service, which would have a corresponding decrease to mandatory non-instructional fees, and I would hope there would be a substitute mechanism for that.
So just to make sure it's very clear, you're saying for this particular clause?
Yeah.
Is that right?
So it's an increase to change.
Is that right? Is there a seconder for this particular amendment? Councillor Zhang, Councillor Lark, would you like to introduce? Would you like to speak in favor of your amendment? Just to.
I do trust this conversation happened in policy committee, and I do trust the committee, but I think in principle, this would work then in tandem with ensuring that we have a student approval mechanism in case the university decides on the removal of a service which would affect the mandatory non-instructional fees. So if it would clash with a policy where it says it requires a student approval mechanism for the removal of a service, but will only require a student approval mechanism for increased mandatory non-instructional fees. And I know of no situation where this has actually happened, but it could, and I think policy should reflect all future possibilities as best we can.
Is there any further debate on this amendment? Vice President Kinda.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, and thank you, Councillor Lark, for that. This was brought up in policy committee, and the decision was to leave it as is. And I guess I'll kind of explain the reasoning for that. So while it does make sense to add the word change, because, you know, it makes sense. However, having the word increase, I think, makes the policy stronger. In my time, I don't think I've ever seen an instance where there's ever been somebody wanting to decrease the fee. Like, that's never really happened. And if it was going to happen, I don't know if that would even require a student approval mechanism. The main reason for this policy and for this be resolved clause is that if and when anybody wants to introduce a new fee or increase an existing fee, that poses a significant cost to students, and that's a financial barrier for students. And in that regard, it makes sense to have a student approval mechanism, such as a referendum or a plebiscite, to indicate how students feel. If it was a decrease, I'm pretty certain most students would feel that, hey, we're paying less, that's great. So in that sense, just basing this on history and how students generally tend to think, I personally believe leaving the word increase makes the policy stronger.
Councillor Zhang.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I was speaking in favor of this amendment, and like VP Kinda said, this was brought up a policy, and I also spoke in favor of that in joint policy committee. And my reasoning being, whereas states that students are willing to pay a reasonable fee for services that benefit students. So I think that, in my understanding, the university, to my recollection, they have never done this before, but they could potentially say, we are going to cut this fee, and we are also going to get rid of a certain service. And if the student body feels like they'd rather keep the fee and keep the service because they feel like the service is beneficial to them, I would like for us to be at least have the option of supporting that. Just because I don't want to limit our freedom of advocacy for both lower fees, but also for beneficial services that will make the fees make sense. Thank you.
Vice President Orzik.
I'd like to speak against this amendment.
The spirit of this bylaw is to direct executives on matters of financial barriers to education, not to direct executives on matters of what services should or should not be provided. Therefore, this amendment is not in line with the spirit of the bylaw, and we should vote it down.
Thank you, Vice President Wurzik. Vice President Diaz.
I would like to speak against this as well. Because if we're talking about a change in the fee, there's an error in the logic to say that a decrease in the fee would be a reduction in service. So if any time the fee goes down and the service is still in place and we go to referendum, it's an inefficient process. It costs money to hold a referendum. We're spending stupid money every time we do that. So for me to look at this as a financial focused change to the policy, it would have to be contingent on proving that the service had been cut. As it is, I'm comfortable leaving it as an increase because that captures the affordability goal of this particular Liberal policy.
Councillor Zhang.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I think that when we talk about university fiscal responsibility, we need to note that for a university to be responsible, they need to ensure that their services are being provided in adequate measure and that the fees are being used in a reasonable way. So I don't think that there's a possibility for us to I don't think that there's a possibility for us to completely separate the fiscal activities of the university with the services that they're going to provide with that money. So therefore, I think that not only do we have to ensure that the university is responsible when they increase a fee, we have to ensure that the university is responsible when they change a fee. We don't know what a change of fee is going to mean. They might not cut the service, they might cut the service. We don't know that. That's really what the university is going to decide, which is why I feel like we need to have the option to advocate for whatever we want, depending on the decision that the university makes. Thank you.
Mr. Kim.
I'd like to speak against the amendment in the sense that increase reflects the objective of the Students' Union and this policy in the most clear manner possible, and then changing it into change would add too much room or unnecessary flexibility, which could also harm us in the long run. So for the purpose of this policy, I believe that it should stay as increase as opposed to change.
Thank you, Mr. Kim. Mr. Rahman.
Super. So thank you, Mr. Speaker. We've heard kind of a consensus from executives that they are opposed to this amendment, and we've seen a little bit of pushback from councillors. And I think that the important thing now is that we need to trust in the judgment from our executives. They're a lot more dedicated to the day-to-day business of the Students' Union, and they understand what it takes to advocate to university administrators. So that's why I think it'd be better to trust in the judgment. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Governor Hassara, please refrain from making comments like this. Governor Hassara.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Watch your words. I will begin.
While I agree with the executive on this matter, I think they're in the right. I think President, Vice President Diaz and Orzik eloquently quite what that is. But let me remind, I think it's important to remember that as councillors, we are expected to hold the executive and the Board of Governors representative accountable. And there's nothing wrong with pushback when merit is done. That is our job, and I think it's important to not be a blind staff to our decisions. And to constantly criticize us and question us and question our judgment. And don't ever forget that. Thank you.
Councillor Allard.
I would like to speak in favor of my own amendment. just because those who have been opposed to the amendment have been focusing on the advocacy side of... it is a stronger term for advocacy purposes to say increase the existing mandatory non-instructional fees, and I don't think that anyone would disagree with that. But I think that our policy needs to acknowledge the chance that a removal of service would come with a corresponding decrease in mandatory non-instructional fees, which was ignored by VPDS or our VPSO. In his point. So, unless I'm mistaken, and there is another policy that more adequately will deal with this issue. And I think that we should keep, or we should change item to be the favorite.
Thank you, Councilor Lard. Vice President Diaz.
I'd like to, like, so you, Councilor Zhang mentioned the ability for us to be, to have the power to choose whether we held the referendum plebiscite about. Okay, well, what I heard, may I finish a sentence? So what I heard was that if they're cutting a fee to cut a service, we should hold them accountable and get the student voice to oppose that. The students are willing to pay for a service that they want to receive. If they're reducing a fee because the service became more efficient, I'm of the opinion that we should have the power to advocate, to convey that to students and not waste thousands of dollars holding a plebiscite on that matter. Now, I'm comfortable with us clarifying that in this particular policy, but I don't believe it's captured in the current amendment. I believe it may be better achieved through a different view for the result, perhaps, where we articulate that the students' union will advocate for a student approval mechanism where a reduction in the fee results in a reduced service for students.
I have a request for information.
If Councilor Vice President Diaz is...
Yeah, sure.
So the student approval mechanism, does that automatically mean that if there was a decrease that we would have to run a referendum to see what the students of
the that's what we advocate for, as far as I'm aware, is that student approval mechanisms are the student's community mechanisms.
So my question would be, can we have a student approval mechanism that doesn't require a plebiscite or a referendum? My understanding is that we can have a student approval mechanism that doesn't cost a significant amount of money.
Yeah.
Can we have something like that?
Thing I can think of is the vote of council, which is, we have seen that before. So besides a referendum or a plebiscite, us councillors can vote on behalf of our students.
I have a follow-up.
It's up to them whether they're willing to take it or not.
Just another point of information. So in this policy, when it says advocate for student approval mechanism, is the intention that it's a plebiscite or referendum? Is that the intention of that wording?
The intention of this wording is, honestly, to make sure that students have a voice and an input on whatever's happening. And depending on who we're negotiating with or talking to, we have to have some room of flexibility. Ideally, referendums would be great. But realistically speaking, there are other mechanisms of gauging student voice. So those are those three mentioned.
Councilor Lard, unless it's to make an amendment to your amendment. Okay. Want to withdraw your amendment?
Yes. If I do that, then what would I be able to propose?
Sure. The only way I'll allow this amendment to be withdrawn is if there is no opposition to it being withdrawn. There must be unanimous consent that the motion is withdrawn. So I'm assuming you want to withdraw your amendment?
Yes, to propose an additional fee for result.
Okay, so let's do this one step at a time. Is there any opposition to this amendment being withdrawn? Councillor Zhang, are you sure?
No.
No opposition?
No.
All right. We'll go back to the original wording. And I'll recognize Councillor Lard, who would like to make an amendment.
I'd like to propose an amendment to add an additional be it further resolved clause that would read, be it further resolved that the University of Alberta's students will advocate for a student approval mechanism for a decrease in a mandatory non-instructional fee associated with the removal or change in scope.
Do you have that written down somewhere?
Yes.
Okay. Do you mind if I have a look at it?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm just going to add this. I'm just going to add this right here so I don't have to move any ads or anything like that. For this amendment? I repeat again, is there a seconder for this amendment?
Sure.
Councillor Farouk. All right, Councillor Allard, would you like to introduce your amendment?
I removed my original amendments, based on all the feedback I was getting that the intention of that via further resolve clause is to advocate against the increase of mandatory non-instructional fee. And I believe that adding a further via resolve clause will give us the flexibility to initiate a student approval mechanism or advocate for the initiation of a student approval mechanism in the case of a decrease in a mandatory non-instructional fee associated with the removal or decreasing quality of the service. Which is, as far as I can tell, the only time when I think Students' Council would advocate against a decrease in the mandatory non-instructional fees. And this, I believe this gives us the flexibility to advocate for services or maintain the quality and of our services as well as advocate in the favor of the students in the change of a mandatory.
All right, for the purposes of this amendment, I'm going to limit debate to 2 minutes. Vice President Hodgson.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. And I'm going to start off by saying I'm strongly opposed to this amendment. I think there's a misconstrued notion over the services the university provides for their fee. For one, I would not count all of them as the services. They registration and transcript fee, sure that's a service, but I kind of really expect as part of my tuition the university to provide my transcript so I can apply for other things afterwards, and I have to apply, I have to pay an additional fee for this supposed service. If council would allow me to read through papers for briefly.
Is there any opposition to Vice President Hodgson reading through papers? Wonderful, go ahead.
So I think the fee that best falls under this category is the student services fee. From the university registrar's website on mandatory non-instructional fees, this fee supports the provision of ongoing services from the Office of the Dean of Students and associated offices such as Aboriginal Student Center, our Student Services Center, Academic Support Center, Augustana Student Services, CAPS, Math and Applied Sciences Center, Specialized Support and Disability Services, and so on and so forth. There's about 15 blanket services that you pay one fee towards. One of those things is they contribute funding to our own services. The DOS provides us a grant every year, that's the Dean of Students. That grant was slashed this year. So under this policy, we would need to hold a referendum or a council vote on there was a reduced service. They reduced our funding. So what does that mean? By legislating or by having a policy where we're tucked into a corner and have to act a certain way over this funding cut, we have to have the discussion at council, and we can't have a discussion with the DOS first about what this means and what this means for services we provide. It really ties the hands of how we can react to these kind of situations. Same if the Aboriginal Student Support Center. All of a sudden, disappears. That means we have to all have a discussion at council or have a referendum or plebiscite around this issue. I don't think that's the appropriate response.
All right. Thank you, Vice President Hodgson. President Lau.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I'm struggling a bit here, as I'm sure many of your other councillors are, because I know that the intent of Councillor Lard's and the intentions of his amendments are genuine and are positive. Unfortunately, though, the one issue I have with the amendment that's being proposed, whether it's the previous one or the current one, is that the Students' Union isn't in a place to have a student approval mechanism for a fee that's already being collected. See, right now, even the first clause states that be further resolved that the U of A Students' Union advocate for a student approval mechanism. Because the university can collect mandatory non-instructional fees without our approval, it is simply a courtesy if they choose to allow us to have a say in holding a plebiscite, a referendum, or a council vote in the collection of the new fee, or a change in the fee such as the athletics and recreation fee last year. The situation here is, if the university ever chooses to decrease or remove an existing service, we aren't the decision makers in the reassessment of the fee collection. So no matter what we run, if it's a referendum, it would be foolish of us because we don't actually have the power to change the fee collection. If it's a plebiscite, I would almost say it's a poor use of resources, like Vice President Diaz stated, because we would already be in conversations about how to keep the service, quality of service, either maintaining it or holding it up to our standards. So I think the intent of this amendment is understood. I think we would do whatever we want to maintain or increase the quality of the services we receive from the university. But to have us run a student approval mechanism for something we don't have decision-making power over, I feel isn't.
Thank you, President Lau. Governor Hansara.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Welcome to council, guys. Because this is the first of many debates that council will have with the executives. On their power and their leeway. There's the discussion appears to be is clearly becoming debate between how much leeway we want to give the executives towards Vice President in the disagreement.
What a parliamentary privilege, Mr. Speaker.
Yes.
You're questioning motives.
No, I'm not questioning motives. It's not. Let me go ahead. It's not motives. There's always you have to give the executives. Let me finish. You have to give the executives and the president. Let me finish.
Councilor Bannister.
Is it appropriate to talk about debate as a general concept instead of the specific amendment at this time?
It's a very interesting point.
It's not a rule of point of order. It's fine.
I can see where Councilor Bannister is coming from. I can also see where Governor Hansara is coming from, and I think if you give him a couple more seconds, he's actually going to clarify where he's actually intending to go with this point. So
you guys know the facts. And for me, the issue is, essentially, you can't get... There can't be a mechanism for everything. Every little thing can't be legislated in the political policy. We need to trust that our executives are doing the right thing. And I know there's a battle between, having everything managed and having as much counsel say in everything as well. And that's the internal battle that's been going on for the 4 years that I've been on council. But at the end of the day, this
undercover matters. Thank you, Governor
Hansara. No, there's a lot of point of parliamentary increase.
I'm recognizing Councillor Zhang because you had a point of parliamentary inquiry during another point of parliamentary inquiry, which I didn't want to address at the time, so...
I wanted to know if I was out for him on the speed
Almost. It's almost victory, don't worry.
No, I want to know because I need to go to the washroom.
Okay, well, hurry up. You have 2 minutes or less.
Okay.
Vice President Diaz.
Is the exact
example, let's see, like the current student services fee goes to a lot of different things, as you can watch it played out. A lot of the different things that it goes to also find church other sources of funding. So if there's a hypothetical service that loses its grants and is no longer able to operate, and they propose to also remove the portion of the fee that goes to that service that no longer is operational, what function would a mandatory reduction of service and approval mechanism have in that context, wherein the service would not be provided, the university would, if the students voted in favor of keeping the service which the university could not afford to provide, would they just keep the money and put it elsewhere? And isn't that contrary to other things that we advocate for, where money goes? So that's just a hypothetical. That's something that could happen. The government is, and different granting bodies can withdraw grants at their leisure on how those timelines might work.
Thank you, Vice President Diaz. We'll skip over Councillor Zhang because he's not here. Councillor Bannister is called to question. Is there a seconder to call to question? Councillor Farouk, who seconded this amendment. Wonderful. Call to question is not debatable, not amendable, and requires a two-thirds majority. All those in favor of calling to question, please raise your placards. Please raise them high and keep them up or down. All those opposed to calling to question, please raise your placards.
Oh, God. Oh, God.
All those in favor again, please raise your placards. All right. That motion carries, so we will vote on this particular amendment. So all those in favor of the additional be it further resolved clause, be it further resolved that the University of Alberta Students Union advocate for a student approval mechanism for a decrease in MNIPS associated with the removal of an existing service. All those in favor, please raise your placards. Wow, great. All those opposed? Any abstentions that wish to be noted? Councillor Allard, Councillor Zhang, anyone else? Wonderful. So we'll go back to the main motion. I'm just going to leave this for now because I have to email this to our wonderful assistant, Nicole, so that she can include this on the votes and procedures for next main agenda. Are there any further amendments or further debate on this motion? Seeing none, put this to a vote. All those in favor of item 6A on the agenda, Kendra Gruelke, on the recommendation of Policy Committee, move to approve the mandatory non-instructional fee policy in second reading. All those in favor, please raise your placards. All those opposed? Any abstentions that wish to be noted? Governor Hansara, Councillor Zhang, thank you. Move on to item 6B. Hodgson Zhang, on the recommendation of Bylaw Committee, move to approve Bill 3 in second reading based on the following principles. The principles are attached, and I believe there's an attached document as well, which gives Council a very good look as to what the new wiki would look like and how the changes would be reflected in there. Hopefully, councillors have actually read the changes. So, assuming that everyone's had a chance to read them, I'll allow Vice President Hodgson to introduce.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. So, if you look at, just to kind of explain how this works, if you want to open your agenda package to the proposed bylaw edits, what we can do is basically a compare function. So, that bylaw 100 is now up on the wiki. We went through and changed all instances of Budget and Finance Committee to, or sorry, Grant Allocation Committee to Finance Committee, and deleted all mentions to Budget and Finance Committee. And so we could do that just by stepping through the actual text there deleting them, putting this new version out, and then saying compare these two. So it actually gives you line by line. You can see line 22. There's like the left side is what it was, the right side is what it is now. So you can see every single change compared left to right. So it's quite nice. The little minus sign means that was subtracted. A plus sign means that was added. Pretty straightforward. The only thing I'll comment on here is every instance of granting an allocation committee was changed to finance committee. References to the budget and finance committee were deleted. The duties of the budget and finance committee were moved under the purview of the newly named finance committee. Membership of the finance committee was moved from five counselors and myself and Vice President Diaz to seven counselors and myself and Vice President Diaz. As well, quorum was bumped from four members to five, because quorum was previously four out of seven members. It's now five of nine. Reflect the original spirit of quorum of 50% plus one, plus it's a Star Trek reference.
Thank you very much, Vice President Hodgson.
Oh, seven.
Is there any debate? Seeing none, the question is put, once again reading the motion. Item 6B, Hodgson Zhang, upon the recommendation of Bylaw Committee, move to approve Bill 3 in second reading based on the following principles. All those in favor, please raise your placards. All those opposed? Any abstentions that wish to be noted? Wonderful. That concludes the agenda. Just want to make some concluding remarks before everyone gets up to start packing and leave. I just wanted to take the time to, how do I say this, in a very polite and political manner, to apologize to council. I think over the last few weeks I'm still trying to figure out exactly how to do this whole speaker thing. Some things I allow just because it's the first time I've done this. It's not like I've done this before. And I think today's meeting I allowed something which I should not have. So on the record, I would like to apologize to council for that. I'd like to apologize to any students at large, any non-counselors, any counselors who felt slighted by that particular non-action of mine. And going forward, I'll do my best to try to correct that mistake. I hope that council realizes that I'm human, that I'm not the all-seeing eye of speakerness, as I continue to refer to. But I just wanted to put that on the record just because I felt like it was necessary to say. So with that, don't forget to hand in your council scholarship forms next Monday by 11:59 p.m. I'll send out a reminder email. Also, don't forget to put your placards back, and we'll take attendance. President Lau, he's here. Vice President Orzik.
Present.
Vice President Kinda.
Here.
Vice President Hodgson.
Present.
Vice President Diaz.
Hello.
Governor Hansera.
Present.
Councilor Allard.
Present.
Councilor Chen is not here. Councilor Bannister.
Present.
Councilor Dueck. Councilor Sleeman.
Present.
Councilor Zhang.
Here.
Mr. Kim.
Present.
Councilor Brulke. Mr. Cassian, I can't pronounce your last name, for Rice. Mr. Rudy for Councilor Bakunde.
Here.
Councilor Horvat.
Present.
Mr. Fredowski. Mr. Jacobson. Councilor Wong. Councilor Gard, Councilor Gore, Mr. Janevsky, Councilor Kruzzi, Councilor Morris. Councilor Bhatia, Councilor Hooper, Councilor Champagne, Councilor Rahman for Councilor Vinchik, Councilor Zinedine, Councilor Kwan, Councilor Wang, Councilor Fruit, Councilor Hudson, and I'm here.
Where?
You calling in?
Is it a steel wheel soap?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, he said sober. Oh, I got you. Okay. I'm just going for like 2 seconds. No worries.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I gave you the opportunity. I was like, yo, man, I think I'm going to get point of order about right about now.
I'll send out an electronic.
Yeah, I thought Corey was going to point of order me, too. To me? Oh, that's cool. He was so pissed. Like, I went to talk to him. He's like,
oh. No, he told me.
Oh, I know. That time you have to say
especially because you're not a member of council.
I didn't reflect the team alive. I said counselors.
Everyone knew who you were talking about.
No matter, it's a council. Read what I said. Hear what I said. I said counselors. I think the students are large. I said counselors.
Did everyone know who you were talking about?
It doesn't matter. I said counselors. I can control what they think of.
Absolutely.
I control what other people say.
So wait, you believe in a court of law, you don't refer to a victim or somebody by their name.
No, I didn't. No, no, no.
By their name, but rather by their actions. You're not referring to that person?
I said
it's completely false.
I said specifically counselors. Specific counselors.
I'm not the smartest guy in the world, but I know what you're talking about. Come on.
I did not refer to nobody. I referred to counselors.
You referred to somebody who called.
Yeah, yeah, that's the gray area. Right. Well, whatever. I said it. They need to hear it. That was the only question.
Just wondering if I could have a form.
I'll send out an electronic copy.
Okay, that's what I was wondering. Thanks.